U.S. back in the U.S.S.R. Well, the delivery girls really knocked me out.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Fiona Hill, who's the director of the Center on the United States and Europe and senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution. She's a frequent commentator on Russian and Eurasian affairs, and she's researched and published extensively on issues related to Russia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, regional conflicts, energy, and strategic issues. She's also a co-author of a new book just out, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fiona Hill.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And how does Tom Donilon make a deal with this very surly Russian administration? There was, of course, the famous reset where Lavrov and Hillary Clinton joked about the button, and it didn't look like pressing the button did the trick. And now they're trying to reset the reset. So what's your expectation that is going to come out of these meetings in Moscow?
Well, I think we have to be very circumspect and cautious in our expectations. Basically, it's going to be very difficult to make a deal with Mr. Putin, and resetting the entire relationship is going to be extremely difficult under current circumstances. However, there may be some areas where we can make a small amount of progress, and I think one of the major features of Donilon's visit to Moscow was to talk about that the one area that is uppermost, which is the arms control agenda, which is still in the interests of Moscow and in the United States. So looking to move beyond the New START agreement that was signed over the last couple of years and to try to see if we can make some headway on the next round of arms control and potentially the non-proliferation agenda that's been quite important for the administration. Beyond that, to be honest, there's really not a lot that we can really expect to achieve at this stage.
And of course, Fiona Hill, the relationship at the moment is sidetracked and somewhat mired in what's being called the Magnitsky Affair. And of course, just to briefly summarize, Magnitsky was a lawyer who blew the whistle on some Russian government officials who had embezzled an enormous amount of money, I think about $300 million or $200 million. And instead of them going to jail, he went to jail and was badly treated in jail and died in jail. And the U.S. Has passed a law somewhat similar to the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, is it not? It's a human rights-related law called the Magnitsky Law.
That's correct. I mean, it was actually passed and initiated by Congress, although, of course, the president had to sign that into law. And in many respects, it was a trade, even a replacement for the Jackson-Vanik Amendment. The administration has actually been trying to lift that from Russia. You know, that will, of course, put some restrictions on trade with Russia, certainly prevented Russia from getting most favored trading nation status on the basis of the Soviet Union having restrained and, in fact, blocked Jewish emigration from the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And the administration argued quite rightly that, of course, those restrictions had been lifted. And they really wanted to move the Jackson-Vanik Amendment off the books once the Russia joined the WTO last year. But there was an awful lot of pressure within Congress and from many other quarters outside to keep some kind of legislative constraint on Russia, given the persistent human rights violations. And this is what came out of the congressional action and the action of a number of groups that have been very concerned about what Russia's been up to.
And in response to that, the United Russia, controlling the Russian Duma in a fit of pique, banned the adoption of Russian children. And at this point, then following that, there's been these competing lists,
right,
lists and counter-lists of who's banned, including some of the people involved in the Magnitsky Affair. But there's also a classified list, is there not, on the U.S. side?
Well, apparently so, yeah.
And in response, of course, it's important to point out that Russia's now decided to ban a number of senior people from the Bush administration, officials from Guantanamo, including Vice President Cheney, David Addington, and John Yoo. So what's your sense of what's on the public list and what may be on the classified list?
Well, I mean, the Russians are trying to always look for sort of reciprocity. They've always accused the United States of some kind of double standard when it comes to issues like this. And they're also trying to highlight, they actually put out a report on the U.S.'s own deficiencies on the human rights front a year ago, actually in the last several months. And they're also then targeting what they argue are the equal abusers of human rights in the United States who are otherwise not getting their due recourse and scrutiny in the international arena. So, as you rightly mentioned, they've listed a number of Bush-era administration officials who were involved in acts of torture around Guantanamo. And they've also, apparently looking at the list, picked on people who were involved in the prosecution extradition of Victor Boot, the infamous Russian arms trader who was interdicted in Thailand and is now supposed to stand trial here. So that's kind of an odd and interesting item. But look, this is very much part of a pattern over the last 20 years of relationships between the US and Russia. We go through these horrible periods of tit-for-tat accusations and lists, usually about spies, but often about other issues entirely. We've gone through so many ups and downs since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Multiple resets. There's a professor at Georgetown University, Angela Stent, who's just completing a book right now on the last 20 years of multiple resets in the relationship. You know, we've been here before, and I'm afraid this is one of these cycles that we're going to go through for some time. And the Russians always play, this, particularly Mr. Putin, a very offensive defense. If you remember, Mr. Putin was quite skilled at judo as a young man. I mean, generally was a black belt, and he's always looking for some kind of leverage and opportunity to make us look bad, frankly, as well.
Well, I'm afraid, though, this in many ways is the legacy of the Cheney era, in as much as the shame of torture will endure, and it's become a perfect gift to dictators and elected autocrats like Putin, has it not?
Well, it's true, and Putin also looks for, you know, current discrepancies in his view in our behavior. There's another issue that he likes to point out to, which is the targeted assassinations by drones. He's had criticism in the past from everything from, of course, Litvinenko, the former KGB agent who was poisoned with polonium in London, many other incidents of clear assassination of officials and others in Russia who have fallen afoul of the Kremlin. You know, certainly lots of murky events, and he just turns around and immediately pushes back with something the United States does that is comparable or other countries. I mean, it's not exclusive to the United States. It's Putin is always trying to show that Russia is not any worse than any other country. So for every time that the Russians are accused of something, he comes up with some kind of equal, in his view, accusation of misbehavior elsewhere. So whenever we do something that doesn't live up to our values or is contrary to the standards that we usually set, the Russians will find a way of throwing it right back at us.
Again, I'm speaking with Fiona Hill, who's the director of the Center on the United States and Europe and a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution. She's a frequent commentator on Russia and is an expert in issues involving Russia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, regional conflicts, energy, and strategic issues. She's also the co-author of the new book, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. Now, in terms of Putin himself, of course, there's a very damning book by Masha Gessen, The Man Without a Face, which sort of connects the dots in so many. You just mentioned the polonium affair in London. There's the Chechen terrorist operation in the theater in Moscow, which Putin himself directed, the bombing of the apartment buildings outside of Moscow that led to the rise of Putin. There's many things that have happened in the shadows in terms of the security forces. And, of course, the Chechen leader Kadyrov, who may well be on this list, seems to be something of a protege of Putin's. How much can you suggest that we're dealing with a kind of gangster here, that this is KGB incorporated that he runs out of the Kremlin and they kind of regulate organized crime and I guess to some extent the oligarchical business structure is not entirely divorced from organized crime itself?
Well, the title of our book, the subtitle, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin, really sums up something very important to remember about Mr. Putin. He started life as an operative, indeed, in the KGB. And that means that he has a very specific perspective on issues related to politics and statecraft. He is actually very unusual in contemporary politics. It's very hard to find someone who has risen up from what is often called the deep state, the unaccountable agencies that are always in the shadows, to the very top of politics. You'd probably have to go back to ancient Rome, Byzantium, and maybe the Italian city-states to find someone from the Praetorian Guard who has risen to such prominence. It's not the same as being from the military and having risen through a military coup or being a political appointee to any of these, you know, big secret service or security institutions as George Bush Sr. was, or as other leaders who have gone through some of these agencies are. So Mr. Putin started his life off carrying out operations, and he brings that same perspective to his position as head of state. If he thinks it's necessary to protect the state and to further their goals, he will, you know, ratchet up the level of the actions and interventions that he thinks are necessary. He will take whatever action he believes is right. And having come from that kind of environment where he was an operative, somebody who conducted clandestine operations, then, you know, he's obviously, his approach is somewhat different from someone who would have come from an accountable, transparent agency where there was scrutiny of their activity. So we have to remember that we're dealing with someone who is very unusual in a contemporary political situation, and also someone who is very skilled at processing information, working with people, which he obviously, you know, has a whole host of connotations. These are two points that he himself repeatedly signals and underscores as being the two skills he really learned in his time in the KGB. He sometimes makes comparisons with himself with others, like George Bush Sr., who were in the intelligence services, but it's really a very different person. He was not really politically appointed. And as you recall, when he was selected to be Yeltsin's successor back in 1999-2000, he really came out of the blue. He was somebody who had previously been very much behind the scenes. And that is what really makes him very unusual. He wasn't a grassroots politician, and he wasn't someone who basically came up normal channels to come to the top of the state.
Well, of course, Fiona Hill, there are degrees of working in the shadows and being in the clandestine services in terms of what you're capable of. And I guess the question that hangs is, to what extent is there blood on his hands in the direct sense of what they euphemistically refer to in the KGB as wet operations? You know, without accusing him of anything, which certainly Masha Gessen has, the fact that the dissident journalist Anna Politkovskaya was murdered, shot on his birthday, if it's not a direct link, it almost feels like a kind of mafia type of thing where it's a gift to the Don. Is that the culture that surrounds him? Is it purely the intelligence world, or is it a hybrid of the intelligence world and the criminal world? Because after all, before the Soviet Union collapsed, the KGB regulated organized crime and, by extension, capitalism or neo-capitalist activities.
Well, I mean, that last point is the most important one. He came out of the KGB from the 1970s and 1980s and into the very early 1990s, when the KGB was directly involved in breaking the back of organized crime and making sure that they were overseeing, in many respects, what was going on there. I mean, very much like the FBI tries to infiltrate and basically bust apart the mafia in the United States and elsewhere, and narco trafficking and gun trafficking, you name it. I mean, the difference in this was that Putin at that period was not like the head of the FBI. He wasn't Mueller. He was somebody down in the ranks of the people who were actually actively engaging with the people that they were working against. So you see him bringing those contacts, those networks, and the kinds of activities up to the very top. So although we can't say with any certainty of exactly what he's ordered, what he's been engaged in, that is the culture from which he emerged. So he emerged from a culture in which the main focus was on compromising, leveraging, blackmailing, and collecting all kinds of information on people, and basically running agents in many respects, and running recruits or people within organizations that you were trying to break up and to infiltrate. So we can entirely expect that Putin would take those up onto the next level. And he would argue back, if he was listening to you, that that's indeed, you know, what happens across the board in other societies, because he looks at the outward manifestation of some of the things we've talked about the use of predator drones in assassinations, the use of sting operations in other settings. What she doesn't realize, of course, is that this has a great deal of oversight and scrutiny in other settings. But he sees this as very much the same, because that's the environment that he comes out of. So he would argue with, you know, you're basically laying this out, what's the problem? Of course, we can see it entirely that that's not what one expects from a head of state.
So as a head of state, Fiona Hill, does he crave legitimacy at the same time exercise unlimited power or power in the shadows and ambiguous power because we don't quite know how bloody his hands are. Does he want it both ways?
His power, I have to say, is not unlimited. And I mean, that's one thing that's, I guess, quite complicated to get across. There are an awful lot of constraints in the environment in which he operates. Because on the one hand, there is, as we're talking about, this shadowy parallel environment in which he clearly operates. But at the same time, he's the head of a state with institutions and a state with a whole regular set of interaction that it has to have on the international arena. And one of the elements of his popularity, and he's been genuinely popular as a political figure in the Russian context, has been his ability to garner respect on the international stage. So he has to conduct himself in a certain way. And in many respects, getting back to where we started, that relationship with the United States is one key aspect of that. The ability for him to hold his own and be held at the same level as his American interlocutors, as well as his Chinese and other global counterparts, is a very important element in his ability to operate effectively at home. So Putin is actually operating now in a very different environment because over the last several years, Russia itself has become a much more democratic, dynamic, pluralistic society. And as we saw in 2011, 2012, when he made his decision to return to the presidency, an awful lot depends now on public opinion and on the popular support of the Russian population and a lot on electoral politics. Putin had a very hard time coming back into the presidency last year, at least a much harder time than he was anticipating, because of a reaction from the public demanding more accountability and more scrutiny and debate about the kinds of issues that that we're looking at. So he isn't, by any stretch of the imagination, completely unfettered and unconstrained leader. There's an awful lot of constraints on him from the long-term performance of the Russian economy, from the political and popular opinion, and many other elements that he has to factor in.
Well, in terms of the agenda with the National Security Advisor Tom Donilon, a meeting on Monday with Putin and other top officials to try to reset this vexed relationship between the United States and Russia. Obviously, a sore point is Syria. And is there any possibility of working something out? You mentioned strategic arms. Obviously, both sides could have overkill in terms of nuclear weapons, and they could save some money and make the world safer and more secure if they got rid of a few. But I'm just wondering here, since he's so much seems to be driven by pique and by a sense of Russia having been humiliated, does he really want to cooperate or does he want to be a spoiler?
Well, on the issue of Syria, Putin is just gaming this out. He's waiting to see what happens. He has a great deal of patience and a certainly high level of tolerance for the chaos and the crisis and the humanitarian disaster that we see unfolding in Syria. His perspective is very different on this. He does not want to see Assad fall, although at this point I think he knows that this is going to be inevitable, but he wants to see what's likely to emerge and also, frankly, what Russia can extract out of this. The longer this goes on, the more seemingly desperate everyone seems to get Russia to agree to some kind of negotiated solution, although, you know, really we've gone past the 12th hour so many times on this that it seems very difficult to figure out how we would get out of this this crisis. But Putin has a great deal of, as I said already, tolerance for the situation, and he's waiting to see how things are going to progress. If Assad falls, he'll make some kind of calculation and, as I said, try to mitigate the blowback against Russia. In the meantime, he's going to fixate on that issue of keeping Assad still at the center of negotiations. He's not going to want to, if you look back, you mentioned the situation in Chechnya. In Chechnya, Putin presided over a very brutal war. In fact, it was an FSB operation for many years. It wasn't a military operation after an initial couple of years and the Chechen War that broke out in 1999-2000. And he refused at all times to negotiate with the opposition. So he isn't exactly in the mood to see that same thing happen in Syria. There's all kinds of other issues in Syria that the Russians are concerned about, including links between Syria and the Russian North Caucasus and Chechnya itself. And so Putin really wants to see how this is going to play out and who is going to emerge in that setting. And he's not in the mood or in any position that he's going to backtrack on any of those staked out goals that he has laid out in terms of having Assad still in the picture and trying to keep the Syrian state together. So we've got a very difficult discussion with Putin on Syria in particular.
Well, just in closing, clearly he's turning back the clock in terms of civil rights, human rights, even gay rights, controls most of the media. Gorbachev recently was very critical of him. Is there any chance, obviously we don't have a lot of leverage and we certainly don't have much moral suasion there, but is there any chance that he will ease up or there'll be more pluralism? I know he doesn't completely control the internet at this point.
I think he's waiting to see how things progress with the opposition. I mean, this is sort of round one of Mr. Putin versus the opposition in the wake of the presidential election. And he's co-opted some of them. He's bought some people off. He's, on the one hand, talked about the creation of new political parties and, you know, some more openness in some local level elections. On the other hand, as you've rightly described, he's come down very heavily on not just individuals, but on whole groups of people. And he seems to have beaten back, for now, the opposition. But I would argue that hasn't gone away. And he'll be basically watching and waiting to see what next emerges. I think the greatest vulnerabilities here are that it's a very personalized political system in Russia. So if something happens to him, then obviously that really upsets the whole situation. And it also is very much dependent on the continued prosperity and economic growth of the Russian state, which in itself is tied to high oil revenues. So if there's any sustained drop in the oil price for a long period of time, then the Russian economy is in trouble. And that really gives Mr. Putin much less leverage than he has now. And also major upheaval on the geopolitical front, the U.S. strike against Iran, some knock-on effects from the collapse of Syria. For example, North Korea, which obviously is in a state of crisis right now on Russia's far eastern borders. There are an awful lot of elements here that are going to be very difficult to deal with. And as Mr. Putin has made himself indispensable in all of these, it's going to be a very difficult juggling act for him.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Fiona Hill.
You're most welcome, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Fiona Hill, who's the director of the Center on the United States and Europe and a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies program at the Brookings Institution. She's a frequent commentator on Russian and Eurasian affairs and has researched and published extensively on issues related to Russia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, regional conflicts, energy and strategic issues. She's also the co-author of the new book, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be talking in a moment about eliminating wasteful spending in the tax code.